Okay, and I am going to mute all. And you do have the ability to unmute yourself, so feel free to do so if you want to make a comment or a question, or you can use the chat window and we will try to monitor that. Linda will be posting into the chat window all of the URLs for tonight's presentation as we go through it, if I remember to tell her when to do so. So we'll hopefully catch all of those. So with that, I will share. And there we go. So tonight's presentation, let's start off. So the first one is a follow-up from Alan, and this was about Skype, and he looked into it a little bit after the video conferencing talk at last week's Q&A. And one of the benefits that was being looked at as a requirement for the person who posted about the video conferencing was that they wanted it free, no time limits, and can do a group of people on the video call. So Skype does have those. You do require a Microsoft account to set up the conference, but you don't need to have a Microsoft account to join an existing video conference. He found the one thing that was kind of odd. He says to set it up so that it's going out to a group, you don't start in your contacts where groups are actually defined. You don't start it in calls. You actually have to go to chats, which even if you have no intention of doing it as a chat, you actually have to start your Skype group in there. So you end up clicking on the blue icon, and it gives a new chat, and you can start your new group, and participants can be selected from there. And so then you start your video conferencing by clicking on the camera icon. I don't think that Alan did very much beyond that. But he just wanted to pass on that idea that seems a little bit non-intuitive that you go into the chats to do it all, but it does work. Okay, another follow-up, computer assistance. There was somebody last week's Q&A who was looking for a senior who was looking for one-on-one assistance. Now, is Natalie with us tonight? I've lost my participants window. There we go. I don't see Natalie with us. She came up with this, so I was going to give her an opportunity to talk about it if she wanted to, but I don't think she's really looked into an awful lot. Connected Canadians is a nonprofit which has its mission of assisting, in particular, seniors, and they do have one-on-one training sessions. And so some of the information from their website is posted on the slide here. So anybody who's really looking for that one-on-one assistance, the OPCUG, we're not really geared towards that. We're more group learning and these Q&A sessions and our monthly meetings where we get together with a large group of people and so forth. So although it's happened in the past where there has been some one-on-one assistance, generally speaking, that's not the route we go. So if anybody is looking for one-on-one assistance, you might want to check out Connected Canadians, and Linda will post that URL into the chat window, and you can check them out. I personally have no experience with it other than the knowledge that the Ottawa Public Library, they have a lot of their video conferencing sessions are hosted by Connected Canadians. So I guess they're around and they do some good work. Okay, next. This is a share I had, and I just wanted to point out that Canada truly is a leader. Unfortunately, it's in the high cost of wireless data. And I found an article, and one of the comments in the article was from a Bell customer who claimed they just got charged $51 for going 500 megabytes over on their 15 gigabyte plan. Kind of outrageous what they charge for overages. So that was a complaint. But the main thrust of this article was in India. Somebody had this picture where if you buy a 35-cent bag of chips, you can actually get 2 gigabytes of 4G LTE data included with it. So pretty inexpensive data. Somebody else actually pointed out in that same article was that this is not all that really unusual in that they said for $6.92 Canadian, you can get 1.5 gigabytes a day for a month, so 45 gigabytes total, along with unlimited talk on any network in the country. So that's really coming out to, you know, about that 35 cents for 2 gigabytes, just expand that out to the 45, and that's about $7. So it looks like wireless in India is really, really cheap, and wireless in Canada is really, really expensive. So just thought that would be an interesting thing to pass on.
Yeah, so Bob Walker here.
Yep.
Our old friend Rob Cross has spent some time in Kazakhstan and is now down in Brazil. And he's told me several times about the ridiculously low cost of high-speed internet in both places and how it's much faster and much better quality than we get here.
Yeah, it's pretty insane what we're paying. I'm with Virgin, and I just downgraded to 3G speed, and I'm getting it for 3 gigabytes for, I think it's $30 or something like that, which is actually quite reasonable from what most of the carriers seem to want from you, but it's still expensive compared to most places in the world, it would seem. Okay, the next one is a computer basics one from me, and this is all about auto-forwarding your mail. So a lot of us have multiple email accounts, and if you want, rather than having to go and manually check each of those accounts for new mail, it can be more convenient if you actually set up your email accounts to auto-forward anything that comes into them to one mailbox. So I've taken the instructions here are how to set it up that if you have a Gmail account, that you can auto forward that mail to somewhere else. So the first thing you do is you click on the gear for settings in the top right hand corner of your Gmail window. And you'll get a pop down menu, and at the top of that, there will be a see all settings. And if you click on that, you'll get a new large size tab come up of a whole bunch of things you can do in all your different settings. And there are tabs across the top, one of which is forwarding and pop IMAP. And you click on that. And then you can click a button near the top of that one that says add a forwarding address. So when you do that, you'll get a dialog box pop up that asks you to put in the address that you want to forward the mail to. So in this case here, I was on my christopherjohntaylor@gmail.com address or mailbox, and I'm saying that I want to forward mail to chris.taylor@opcug.ca, another email address that I have. You'll get an information note just popping up just saying that confirmation code has been sent to chris.taylor@opcug.ca to verify. So you can't sort of accidentally or otherwise force all your mail on somebody else. They have to confirm that this is something that they actually want in that mailbox. So I then go over to the chris.taylor@opcug.ca mailbox, and I get this email that came in from Google, and it says to allow christopher.john.taylor@gmail.com to automatically forward mail to that address. All you have to do is click that link. When you click that link, you actually get taken to a web page with a confirmation dialog box. So it says, please confirm that you really want to forward this mail. And you click on the confirm button, and it'll be set up. But at that point, it's configured, but it's not enabled. So what you do is you go back to the settings, and you'll see that you have two radio buttons there. Disable forwarding is chosen, so nothing is being forwarded at this point in time. But you'll see the line below it, which says forward a copy of incoming mail to chris.taylor@opcug.ca. And then it has, and what do you want to have happen after the mail is forwarded? So you can have it keep Gmail copy, just as if it had just come in normally. You can mark the Gmail copy as read. So presumably if you're getting it in the other mailbox, you're reading it there. You can send it to the Gmail archive, or you can delete the Gmail copy on the presumption that it ended up at the, in this case, at opcug.ca mailbox, so I don't really need it in the Gmail mailbox anymore. So you can choose any of those. And then what you do is choose the radio button to do, to actually do the forwarding. So as soon as you click on that forward copy to, it'll take effect. Now, if you decide you don't want to do the forwarding, you come back to that same place, and if you click on that down-pointing chevron where it says forward a copy of incoming mail to, and it has an address, you can choose remove, and then that will stop the forwarding from actually happening. So a relatively simple way for you to have mail get forwarded from one mailbox to another, and then you only have to deal with the mail in a single location.
We just have a couple of questions, a couple of comments in the chat about mail. So Michelin's asking, Thunderbird wants me to upgrade to V91. Will I have to reinstall everything if I do that?
If it's just a normal Thunderbird upgrade, it'll preserve everything. I get updates to Thunderbird probably every month or two. So there shouldn't be any requirement to do any reinstall if you just do it as an upgrade.
And then Bob was commenting that he believes all OPCUG members have an OPCUG email account. So
no.
Verify? No. Okay.
No, that is board not members? The case. Yeah, it's just board members that have it. It's a little bit of a tedious thing to set up. And in essence, it's a Gmail account anyways. We use the G Suite is what we get our opcug.ca from. And so it's just board members that have access to that.
That's it.
That's it? Okay. Okay, and now we have a share from Stefan. So, Stefan, if you wanted to take over the sharing. And away you go.
Okay, let me pick the right screen here. Okay, ready to go. You yep. See my screen? There we go. So before we talk on how does a GPS receiver determine where it is, we need to talk about the GPS constellation. So the Global Positioning System space segment, so basically the satellite, has a constellation of 24 operational satellites. They have a number of spares already in one of these orbits that they can move if one of these satellites become non-operational. And these 24 satellites are in 6 orbital planes, and they're moving quite fast, 14,000 kilometers per hour. And if you look at the picture on the right, you can see one of these orbital plane here with four GPS satellite on it, and you can see the other 6 orbital plane. GPS satellite fly in the, what they call the medium Earth orbit, MEO, and this is an altitude of approximately 20,000 kilometers. The space shuttle, like the International Space Station, is about 300 or even lower than that, 150. So at 20,000 kilometers, it's quite far, but it's not as far as the GEO, which are 36,000. Each satellite circles the Earth twice a day. And each satellite has an atomic clock, and that atomic clock is precise within 3 nanoseconds or 3 billionth of a second. And we'll see in the presentation why this is important. let's start in 2D before we move to 3D, three lateration. So basically finding your position. So let's say that somebody is telling you that you are 600 kilometers away from location one. So basically you know that you are somewhere on that circle. In order to get a more precise location, if you can get information about another location, say location two, and that location two is telling you that you are 500 kilometers away from that location. Now, I don't know if you see my mouse pointer, but it basically means that you're either here or here. So you need a third location to tell you where you are to figure out if you're there or here. So if location number three, say that you are 700 kilometers from that location, now you know that you are here. If we extend that concept from 2D to 3D, things get a lot more complicated. So instead of dealing with circle, we're dealing with sphere. When two spheres intersect, it's no longer a point, it's a perfect circle. So you're somewhere on that circle. If you have three spheres, so basically three points that you know where these points are and the distance, you're going to have 2 points. And in order to figure out which point is good, you will need a fourth sphere that will intersect in a specific single point. However, the Earth itself can act as a fourth sphere because only one of these two possible points will be on the surface of the planet. The other one will be in space, so you can remove that. So this is why you hear that in order to get a location, the GPS receiver need to see at least three satellites. If you get more satellites, you just get a more precise location. Receiver look to four or more satellites to improve accuracy and provide precise altitude information. Now, the GPS receiver need to do a number of calculations to figure out where you are on planet Earth. But basically, the GPS receiver needs to know two things. The first thing that you need to know is the location of at least three satellites above the receiver. And he needs to know the distance between the receiver and each of those satellites. So how do we do that? The GPS satellite, as we saw, move on an orbit and they broadcast, so they send information. The first information they send is a navigation message, which includes the ephemeris data, so basically where the satellite is and where it's going to be, and this is used to calculate the position of each satellite in orbit. So now with this, with the navigation message, the receiver can answer the first question, the location of the three satellites. At the same time, the satellite broadcasts another signal. It's called the ranging signal, which this one can be used to measure the distance to that specific satellite. So on a particular time, the satellite begin to transmit a very long digital pattern. At the same time, the receiver begin running through the same digital pattern. Obviously, the one sent by the satellite will get to the receiver with a small delay, basically based on the transmission time from the signal to propagate through the various layers in the atmosphere and to reach your receiver. So when you reach that, that lag between the two, between your pattern on the receiver and the one sent by the satellite basically is a duration in time. And with this, if you multiply this by the speed of light, you can determine how far away that satellite is from that receiver. This is why it's very important that we get very precise clock. Not only that, both the clock on the receiver and the clock on the satellites, all of them, need to be synchronized down to the nanosecond. So that's 1 billionth of a second. So to make a satellite position system using only synchronized clocks, you will need to have an atomic clocks, not only on all the satellites, but also on the receiver. These things are fairly big and fairly expensive, so it will not really be practical. So they found a clever way to do that. So the receiver just used a normal coax clock, but it's constantly adjusted. And how they do that? Only the correct time will cause all of the signal that the receiver is receiving to align to a single point in space, the receiver location. So it basically do all the calculation to compute the location, the distance between the 4 or the 3 or the 5 satellite that you can see. Based on that, it does a calculation to discover what is its location on Earth. If the clock are in sync, it will have one solution. If it's not, it will need to adjust its local clock, either a plus or a minus, a millisecond or 1 nanosecond, and do that iteration until he find only one location. And when you have that, bingo, he knows where you are on the planet Earth. So another great thing from GPS is not only that you can compute or get the location that you are on Earth, but at the same time, you get atomic clock accuracy for free. It's being broadcast. And many computer servers on the planet use that information to synchronize their system clock. Because when you do a transaction between banks and stuff like that, sometimes you want to make sure when that transaction was made. So you need everybody to be on the same or have a very precise clock. So that's one source to get very precise clock. You will hear about the differential GPS. So inaccuracies do occur mainly due to the calculation assume constant propagation speed, but this is not correct because especially in the ionosphere and the troposphere, the radio signal do not really go at the speed of light. They go a little bit less than that. And we're talking about nanosecond of difference, but that's enough to create a difference in the location when you finish all the calculation. Also, the radio signal can bounce off large objects, like, for example, a skyscraper or something like that. And because of that, the signal will travel a longer distance before reaching your receiver. So your receiver will think that you're further away from that satellite that you are in reality. So again, this you will not get the precision that you are expecting. And also, even though the satellite broadcast is where it's going to be on that orbit, sometimes there is problems. So they can misreport their own position. So when that happens, again, the distance between the receiver and that satellite will be wrong. So the rest of the calculation will be wrong. So they found a way to address that problem. You need a special receiver to do that. And this is when differential GPS help you correct these errors, and all the system works for that. There's a station that has a known location, so he knows its location, its latitude and longitude, very precise where it is on Earth, and he has also a GPS receiver. And if the GPS receiver says, no, you're over there, that station knows where it is, so he can broadcast a signal that will be only local to that region that says, okay, based on these satellites, you need to move your location like 20 meters to the left or up or down or something like that. And if your GPS receiver is equipped to receive that, and there is one of these station that transmit that information, it broadcasts basically a signal that you can correct for that error, so your GPS signal your GPS position become very, very precise. So this is how basically a GPS receiver works, and you can see that sometimes when you open your GPS for the first time. Sometimes it takes a long time before you compute your location. That's probably because the clock inside the GPS, inside the GPS receiver had to guess a number of times or which way to adjust its clock to compute your position. And most of the time when you, if you do the GPS find your position and you're turning off and you turn it on again, the clock will still be fairly in sync and the calculation will go much quicker. Any questions?
I don't see anything in the chat. Does anybody have any questions before we move on? Okay. Well, thank you very much, Stefan. I thought that was a really interesting overview of how GPS works. And in particular, I like your last part that talks about the time it takes. I always wondered why my GPS would take so long to sync up with satellites. And yeah, as you say, sometimes it's minutes before it'll actually lock in.
I don't know what kind of algorithm they are using to make these clock adjustments, but obviously there's maybe some that are better than others. and it also maybe based on the constellation, you should always have a number of satellites in your field of view. But if you are in, I don't know, if you get to the airport, you go get your rental car and you are in one of these parking garage that is all made of concrete, the signal you get may not be that good, and you may not have enough satellite in the field of view so that you can do all of these calculations.
Yeah, true. Jocelyn had a question. Is the GPS being upgraded?
I think they are at the fourth version of the space segment. So the satellite gets better, their life expectancy. So how many years they expect the satellite to work in space gets longer and longer and longer. And there's other, the one I showed you is the one done by the U.S. Government, but there is a couple of other countries that I put their own constellation. So you need to get a receiver for these constellations. Like I think the Europe and China have their own system. I think they are afraid that the U.S. may cut them off. Who knows?
Yeah. I think there's a Russian one. Gloss something. There's a Russian one that does the same thing.
Yeah.
Okay. And we have a comment from Serge Aric. Totally new knowledge for me as well. And well explained. Thanks, Stefan. Allison said very interesting, and B says very interesting. Thanks. So thanks very much for sharing that, Stefan.
Okay, no problem.
Okay, we'll go back to the deck. And go, and we'll carry on. So there was a bit of a discussion came in on some emails to the question or suggestion box at opcug.ca address about HEIF images. And so I did a little bit of research on it and found out that a little bit of information. So it stands for high efficiency image file format, and it indeed is much more friendly to your disk space, I guess, than JPEG, to the tune of it's about half the size of JPEG images for similar quality. The specification for it was actually defined back in 2013, and it really is a container that can hold varying types of image data, including video and still images and things like that. Apple was the first major adopter, and as far as I can tell, they're still the only major adopter. They did it in iOS 11 in 2017, and it became their default format for images. So there are some other platforms apparently that are slowly adopting it, but it seems to be pretty rare still. And you might actually see it as HEIC as the file type, and that stands for High Efficiency Image Container. As I said, it can contain various types of data in that container. And there was the problem, as I see it, is that you get an Apple user typically will send you a photo and it'll be in HEIF or HEIC format, and you can't open it on your Android phone or your Windows computer. And so the solution to that is to find either a viewer that will allow you to view it or a converter that will allow you to convert it to some other file format, such as JPEG file format. So Eldon, who came up with this original posting to that our email address, he had actually looked into it a little bit, and he found that there are Android apps that are available that can do the conversion to JPEG. I don't think he has actually really done an awful lot on that. Eldon, are you on the call tonight? I don't see his name here. So I don't think he's done an awful lot of work on it. He just came across this web page that talked about the various apps that are available for doing it on Android. Personally, I don't care about Android because nobody sends me anything of any interest on my phone. And so what I was really interested in was dealing with it on Windows. And I sort of wondered why EarthView, which can display all kinds of different image formats, it wouldn't display HEIC files. And Eldon had actually sent me a couple of them, and EarthView just showed a black box. So I went into the FAQ at EarthView, and I found out why. Because there was one question, how to load HEIC files in EarthView, and it said that you must install the HEVC extension or codec. And one of the options, option number two on there, was that if you have Windows 10, you can install it from the Microsoft Store. And I actually kind of like things going in from the Microsoft Store because they are very clean about the way they go into the system, and they're very clean about the way they come out of the system. So they claim you need to install two extensions from the Microsoft Store, and they gave you the link to those, and it would take you to the Microsoft Store. And that led me to my first problem, is that they wanted $1.29 to buy one of the two extensions. I think the other one is free, but one of them, they were going to charge $1.29. I'm a cheap SOB, and I figure, why should I spend any money, even if it's only $1.29, if I don't have to? So I searched around some more. So I went back to the FAQ, and one of the options was search on the internet for copy trans HEIC Windows codec and install it, and it's free for personal use for Windows 7 right through Windows 10. And so I did that search, and I came up with that, and Linda will post that URL into the chat window. So I downloaded and installed it, and sure enough, no problem. So it allows you to preview or browse or print HEIC images using Windows Explorer. And that is all without having to even convert it. So it'll just allow you to deal with the HEIC images natively. And the website says that it may help other image viewers like Fastone Image Viewer or EarthView, which I use, to actually handle HEIC files transparently so that they will just be able to be seen within those viewers. And I can attest to the fact that once I installed it, EarthView now happily will display HEIC files for me. Now, if you need it to actually be in a JPEG format anyways, CopyTrans HEIC can convert them, including the ability to do batch conversion of, you know, dozens or hundreds at a time, and it will actually preserve a lot of the image data, like the date taken, geolocation, and so forth. And it's pretty easy to deal with. All you have to do is in File Explorer, you just right-click on the file or the image that you see, and you choose the option in the context-sensitive menu to convert to JPEG with CopyTrans. And sure enough, you end up with an extra file in that same folder as the original, and it's just the JPEG version of it. And to me, it was every bit as good as the HEIC version of the file. So if you have a need to do accessing HEIF or HEIC image formats, I can heartily recommend CopyTrans HEIC as a utility to enable you to do that. There are other programs out there. I noticed some in the Microsoft Store. Some of them had limited capabilities for free, and you could pay a little bit of money and get unlimited usage. Some of them would be like you can do 10 a day conversions and things like that. One of them my firewall popped up as soon as I ran the program that it was trying to access the internet. And I thought, well, why bother? If I use CopyTrans HEIC, it didn't want to go out access the internet. I don't know what this other program was doing. So I just seemed to be quite happy with this one program. So are there any questions that
there was a comment in the chat from B that when she emails a photo from her iPhone to her Simpatico account, it downloads as a JPEG. So what circumstances do the HEIC get created?
I do not know. I thought from everything I read that Apple had switched to HEIC as the native format, but that may not be the case. I don't know if B is getting something, a difference on there, or maybe it's being converted along the way automatically on her behalf, knowing that most people can't deal with HEIC mm-hmm. at this point in time. Maybe. I really don't know.
Okay, that's all.
Okay. Thanks very much, folks. So now we have one. Now let's see if Sue is on the call tonight. Yes, Sue, you're on the call. Do you want to talk to this particular item yourself or just have me go through what information I had found? You'll have to unmute yourself if you want to talk to the item. And I don't see Sue unmuting herself. So I will just carry on with this then. So Sue had a problem that she had some old Microsoft Word document files from 1984. And when she tries to open them in Microsoft Word, she gets this error message. So Word experienced an error trying to open the file, and it had some suggestions about file permissions, making sure there's sufficient free memory or disk space, and the option to open in the text recovery converter, which will allow you to extract out whatever text it can, and you lose all the formatting and things like that. So Sue was wondering how she could actually open those files. So the first thought I had was that it might be a recurring bug that seems to pop up every now and then with Microsoft Word and all of the Office applications, quite frankly. And the way it's supposed to work, if you download a file from another computer, typically across from the internet, but I think any other computer will exhibit this problem, is when you open the file, you get that yellow banner across the top of it saying that you're in protected view. Be careful, the files could contain viruses, and unless you really need to edit it, that you should stay in this protected view where you can't print it, you can't edit it, you can't do anything with it really except read it. But if you do trust it, you can click that enable editing button, and then you're able to edit. So that's the way it's supposed to work. But instead, there's a recurring bug that pops up from time to time where you get that dialog box saying that it experienced an error, and it will not display the file when this happens. And I've run across this personally twice, where it actually happened, and Microsoft corrected the bug quite quickly, but they've done it at least twice. If you get into this problem where you get that dialog box or popping up saying that there's an error in the file, you can unblock the file. The problem is really originating with the fact that the file came from somewhere, another computer on the internet, and it's flagged as being from another source. And that's what's causing this pop up. So in order to get around that, all you have to do is go to File Explorer, right click on your file, choose properties. And then in the properties dialog box down at the bottom, you have that security section where it says this file came from another computer and might be blocked to help protect this computer. And there's a checkbox to unblock it. All you have to do is click that checkbox, and that will unblock it. And my experience has been that you can then easily, just open the file normally, and you don't get that error saying that, there was a problem with the file. So that may be what's happening in this circumstance. The other thought I had was that it might actually be due to the fact that Microsoft just decided this is an unsafe file. Because these were files that were some 16 years old, quite a few years back, Microsoft, for some reason, decided that some of their very old file formats had inherent insecurities, and they decided that the way to fix that was to just refuse to open them. So you just get this error message saying that it can't deal with this particular file. So the Microsoft Office programs would refuse to open them, and one possible solution to that would be use something else to open them. So LibreOffice is available for free, and Linda will paste this URL into the chat window as well. So if you do run into this problem, I would suggest trying that. Just go into LibreOffice, open it up. It should be able to deal with all of the Microsoft file formats, including the very old ones. And if it does successfully open it, then you can save it into one of the more modern formats, maybe DocX or something like that. So those are two suggestions that I have. I don't know if anybody else has any ideas that they've seen that particular error message, have any ideas about how to deal with it. Getting some sound in the background, but not very intelligible, so I'm not sure. I think Sue is trying to talk, but Sue, I'm afraid your mic is really garbled. Okay. So does anybody else have any idea, or Sue, did you actually try either of those options to deal with it? If you wanted to put something into the chat, we could pass on that word if you found any other solution.
Right here. Yeah, I had this problem over the years and never knew how to deal with it. I'll try those two solutions. I still have a lot of old files that don't open. So thank you, Chris.
Okay. Maybe next week you can pass on word as to whether it actually fixed the issue for you.
Now, if I can find those files again.
Yeah. The first one, it really, I've come across it twice, and Microsoft fixed it in both cases. So the first case where it was unblocked the file, that never should have occurred. It is a bug, and Microsoft fixed the bug at least twice. And I have not experienced it in current versions of the Microsoft Office apps. I use Office 2019, and I haven't experienced this in about a little over a year ago. I actually brought this up at Q&A because I had run across it then, and I had bugged it with Microsoft, and within about 3 or 4 days, I think, they had actually come out with an update that actually fixed the problem. So that, I think, is a little bit less likely to actually be the issue here, because Microsoft does sort of update things silently in the background quite regularly. So I kind of doubt that that was it. But this idea that Microsoft thinks it's an unsafe file format might be cause for that to come up. And I'd be really interested in whether LibreOffice actually does present a solution in this case. Alan and I are going to be doing a presentation next spring, Office SmackDown, and we're going to be talking about some of the differences between LibreOffice and Microsoft Office, and this could be something that I could say, well, maybe LibreOffice has more power than Microsoft Office in certain circumstances.
Do you know the difference between the .doc and the .docx more than just a different year?
It's a real different file format. DocX is actually all the X formats. It's actually an XML format file, and it's actually a zip file. And so if you rename something .docx, if you rename it to .zip, you can open it up as a zip file, and you'll see there could be dozens of files within that basically describe the format of the file, as well as the actual text that goes in it. You'll have separate images that'll be actually separate image files that are in that zip file. The .doc format is a binary file that is not easily interpreted outside of Microsoft's own code to, say what exactly is going on within the file.
To convert from .doc to .docx, you need to do it within Microsoft, save it as a .docx. not just rename the file, right?
That's right. That's right. It is a completely different file format. And one of the interesting things we Alan and I have discovered about LibreOffice is that it seems to do a really quite good job of taking a LibreOffice document or any document in LibreOffice and exporting it as a .docx format. And it seems to open up quite well within Microsoft Word or PowerPoint or Excel, whatever Office app you're using. The reverse is not so true. So the fidelity or the ability for Microsoft to correctly interpret the open document format files is not so good. We'll have more to talk about that next spring for sure.
Chris, if there's time, there's just a couple comments going back to the HEIC, if you want to.
Sure.
So there's a question from Glenn, is HEIC open source or proprietary?
Yeah, I don't know actually on that. The very fact that there don't seem to be a lot of free conversion utilities at this point in time, and the fact that IrfanView has chosen not to include natively in their program, I'm wondering if there isn't a licensing issue about it, and that some people that are putting out converters, that's why they're doing some for pay, and they maybe give more limited capabilities. Maybe they have to pay a licensing fee or something. But I really don't know on that one.
Okay. And B replied that the photo is an HEIC on the iPhone. So when I use my iExpand drive to copy from the iPhone, it comes across as HEIC.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Yeah, I mean, Apple has tried to push the industry in certain directions several times on different technologies and so forth. I don't know if this was overly ambitious on their part to abandon JPEG as a standard and embrace HEIC. There's certainly advantages in space size, you know, the physical space of the files. There definitely is an advantage to HEIC. Other than that, I don't know that there are any other advantages to that.
Okay, that's everything.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, Bob Walker here. Going back to the Microsoft Word issue.
Yep.
In the early days of Microsoft Word, Microsoft Word files got corrupted quite easily. And one of the bragging points about the original old OpenOffice was that it could open up Microsoft Word files that Microsoft couldn't.
Yeah.
and Microsoft came up with a utility developed by a third party that you could buy off them to fix their files.
Yeah, I haven't. I remember hearing some of that going back quite a bit. I haven't heard much along that lines in recent years, but yeah, it is nice to know that there are other options like LibreOffice that seem to be able to do a credible job of opening up the Microsoft format files. Interesting. Okay, that's all we had in the queue for tonight. So are there any other questions that people wanted to unmute themselves and ask or put into the chat window? Give it a little bit of time here. I don't see anything going into the chat at this point. So I think then we will just carry on with the wrap up for the evening. If you have anything, jump in before we close off the call. So a reminder that the October meeting, Bob Walker is going to be giving a presentation on the history of the digital revolution. And so that should be an interesting talk coming up on October 13th. And then a reminder that the Tech Cafe sessions are now open for registration at the Ottawa Public Library website. And so you can find them all listed there. There are five of them coming up through October and into November and into the start of December. And the first one up is going to be Bob Walker talking about renewable energy on Monday, November 8th. 3:30 to 4:30. They will all be on subsequent Mondays, so they're one a week for 5 weeks. They are all Monday, 3:30 to 4:30 p.m. So if you're interested in any of the topics, they are all available on our website, the list of the topics, as well as at the Ottawa Public Library website. If you do want to attend any of them, make sure that you do register at the Ottawa Public Library website. You will be sent a URL that you have to use to actually connect to the Zoom conference. Okay. Michelinda says, got radio button groups to work in Word. Figure Michelle just saying thank you. So the queue is open for next week's Q&A session. So if you have anything for it, either a question, a share, a follow-up to something you've seen in Q&A, anything relevant to Q&A, by all means send it into suggestion box at opcug.ca, and we'll put you on the agenda for next week. So with that, if there are no other questions, I think we will call the evening to an end. And thank you very much, everybody, for attending.
Thank you. All very interesting.
And I lost my camera. I don't know what happened.
I know.
Okay. Good night, all.
Good night.
Find the right button. Yeah, there it is.